You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Craig Stowers was appointed to Alaska's Supreme Court by Governor Parnell in 2009 and was elected to serve a three-year term as the court's Chief Justice last July. Justice Stowers has worked in both public and private law positions in the state since the mid-80s and has been in Alaska since the mid-70s. Last week, Stowers delivered the annual State of the Judiciary address to the legislature in Juneau. He described the way the court system is balancing budget cuts this year and warned lawmakers that further cuts could begin to erode the way the courts serve Alaskans, perhaps especially in rural parts of the state. Stowers is in Dillingham for the official opening of the new courthouse and joined me earlier this morning. Your Honor, thank you for the time.
You're welcome.
Please be seated.
That's my line.
I had to. How is the court system managing current budget cuts?
Well, we're doing all kinds of things, from the very smallest, which is just trying to save dollars here and there on things like travel, supplies, and whatnot. But given the magnitude of the budget cut, we have our three big strategies are to basically achieve savings from attrition when employees leave service. We keep those positions vacant, and that's probably our largest source of savings. Our employees are phenomenal, and they have agreed to voluntarily take leave without pay. From the clerk of court position to even many of our judges, and so we've achieved a very large volume of savings in that regard. And then we also have closed courts on a very limited and targeted basis, and that's our plan. Those three strategies for going forward as well.
Why are rural courts potentially in jeopardy of being closed with future cuts in your mind, or are they?
It's a possibility. We hope not. But the reality is, we have a very limited budget. We're a very small branch of government by way of comparison to the other branches and even many of the other agencies. We have a very large geographic distribution of where our courts are. A lot of these courts in the rural areas have relatively small filings. I mean, some of them 100, some of them maybe 200 or 300 case filings a year. If you compare that, say, to Anchorage, your average judicial officer in Anchorage has maybe 1,200, 1,300 case filings. And in most locations, it's not just the magistrate judge out in the rural area, but it would also be a support staff person to assist with calendaring and filing and data entry and mailings and all of those kinds of things. And so you end up with a situation where you're spending two full-time positions, say, on a court that really doesn't justify two full-time positions. We have some strategies where, we may be able, say, as a magistrate judge retires or leaves service, to cover that court with another magistrate judge from another small area as well. And then I have some other strategies in mind too, but I don't think you want to get that deep in the weeds.
At least not yet anyway. You have mentioned that courts serve as a face of government, a very unique interaction point for the public and its government. Closing courts is not ideal, I don't think, in your mind, is it?
It's not ideal in my mind. It's not ideal from the court system's point of view. And frankly, I think you would get agreement from our brothers and sisters in the legislature and the governor's shop as well. To the extent that it's possible and cost-effective to have some state presence, in rural areas, that's a desirable thing. People have needs. For example, in the realm of our responsibility, if you have a domestic violence situation out in rural Alaska, as you know, there's few areas that have trooper presence there, and it takes a long time for troopers to get there. You have village safety protective officers in some villages, but not all villages, and they're not always there. But at least if you've got access to the courts, then you can start the process of getting a protective order, hopefully putting in place some protection until other authorities or resources get there.
Could tribal courts at some point be a partner with the state's legal system to handle some of these changes?
I think it's possible. This is me speaking, very generally at this point. As you know, there has been a lot of discussion in this administration and past administrations, you know, about what is the proper, you know, role of tribes and their jurisdictional status. And of course, that's an issue that principally, you know, would come from the legislature, you know, with the governor's input. There are mechanisms that we've already put in place so that when tribal courts issue essentially, you know, protective orders from that court, you know, we can register them. We've got new rules in place so that those orders would be treated just like any other state's protective order. So we're making big steps in that regard.
In your speech the other day, and this is something that we've seen quite a bit of, I think, lately, is an increased use of things like video conferencing and even just telephonic hearings to save travel costs when defendants are far-flung from the court that they are being arraigned or tried in. Do you believe that those defendants who are arraigned or tried, or whatever is the hearing is over the phone or video conference, are getting the same quality interaction with the justice system as somebody who gets to look at the courtroom, see their accusers, the attorneys, and the judge face-to-face, eye-to-eye?
I think that they are. I think it's important to understand that there are different levels of proceedings that occur in a courtroom, and some of them on the relatively low end of consequence are status hearings, trial scheduling hearings, things like that. And I think for those kinds of, for lack of a better word, lower end hearings, I think video conferencing is the way to go. At the other end of the spectrum, when you have trials, sentencings, and things like that, absolutely the defendant has a right and should be present in order to face accusers, to face witnesses, and in order to exercise the full panoply of due process.
In your State of the Judiciary last week, you challenged our elected lawmakers with what I thought was some pretty lofty rhetoric, even citing Churchill and such. Sitting atop a co-equal branch of government, I would ask your opinion. Do you think that your colleagues in the legislature are up to the task of these times?
All right. So first, I'm a lawyer. Object to the word rhetoric, although I get it in the classical sense. Maybe that's appropriate. You know, Plato might agree with you. What I tried to do with the members of the legislature was basically to encourage them. You know, the legislature is in a very difficult situation, as everybody knows, with our budget situation and the decreasing revenues. And they have lots of ideas about how to respond to this, and that is their constitutional task. They catch a lot of criticism, and I understand that. You know, people have a right, and indeed we're Alaskans, and so it's our sacred duty, you know, to criticize government in some ways. But I wanted the legislature to hear a positive message that, you know, they are uniquely situated to address these challenging problems that they faced, much as the delegates to our Constitutional Convention were facing a very challenging situation. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention proved it's possible to bring people from a wide variety of political views and views about what government is or should be. And they succeeded in creating a constitution, our state constitution, which is just an astonishing work of statesmanship. And this legislature can do that, and I believe they can do that. I believe that they want to do that. I don't think any of them want to leave this session, you know, not having made major progress, and I'm believing in them.
Your colleague, Justice Dana Fabe, will retire very soon here, I think 2 months. She's been on the court a long time. What's the legacy Justice Fabe will leave behind in the state?
I think her principal legacy is going to be that she has fought and worked very hard to advance the access of the public of all, you know, all kinds to the court system, to the justice system. It's her passion. She believes in it. She's very effective at that. She has, you know, essentially created and participated in what we call our Color of Justice program, which is designed to reach out to students in high school, and especially students of color and diversity, to get them introduced to the idea that perhaps, you know, they could become lawyers and then someday become judges. I mean, we don't have a diversity, and certainly not the diversity that we would like to have on the bench, for example. And she's been, you know, really instrumental in that. But more than that, I would just point out her leadership. I mean, she has truly led the court over a period of years. She's led all kinds of initiatives in the legal field, and we will miss her. And by we, I mean not just the court as it sits, but you know, all Alaskans are going to miss her leadership.
Related question is Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, I believe, is lying in state today at the Supreme Court in the nation's capital. Your thoughts on Justice Scalia, his legacy?
So again, these are my personal thoughts. I've read a lot of Justice Scalia's opinions, especially his dissents. There are a couple of recent biographies of him that are out there. There's one book that is entitled Scalia Dissents, I think, and there's a discussion of some of his more classic dissents. I think that he brought to the Supreme Court and to American jurisprudence a depth of knowledge and reasoning and insight that's really quite remarkable. And he was an excellent writer, and so he sort of set the bar for that. Now, from a political point of view or from a jurisprudential point of view, you know, what your individual view is on where he landed is certainly open to debate, and it's been debated greatly. But I'm thinking just more broadly, he's had an astonishing impact on the law. He's written dissents where he was by his lonesome at one point, and ultimately the entire court came around on that one particular position. I would say, you know, regardless of how you might, you know, view him from certain points of view, he's going to be listed by history, I think, as one of the giants on the Supreme Court.
Do you enjoy your job on the Supreme Court, even before you were Chief Justice?
Very much so. I enjoy the law. I enjoy history. I enjoy working with people. When I was a trial court judge, I enjoyed working with people, real people, having real problems in real time. Now I'm on the appellate court, and I don't get the opportunity to work with the people so much, but still the problems that people bring to courts to have us solve for them and to make a contribution to the state is just a very humbling thing, and I'm honored to do that.
Chief Justice Craig Stowers, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time today. You're welcome.